It's like watching a movie, a reel spinning a clip from my life, and I can almost place where else I've seen that actress before. I lean forward in the overstuffed red faux velvet chair, and if I squint hard enough, I can almost see myself in the screen. The actress sits on a frayed cot and opens her army green sea bag and begins to pull out her gear. First come the armor plates she will put into the chest and back pockets of her flak vest to protect her. They'll be replaced 9 months into the deployment when it's proven that they crumble upon first impact. Next, she yanks out the black sleeping bag she will use as a comforter for the next 364 days without washing. Clanging against the cement floor are 8 M16 magazines she will schlep with her everywhere. To the chow hall, to the tactical operations center, to the shower trailers, and to her friend's fallen soldier's service. Then she unpacks her extra boots, desert camels that will be washed exclusively with rust water, and books to help pass the boringest of times. She unwraps her new journal that will soon be filled with lines of doubt, loneliness, despair, and even a little hope. She tapes photos to the wall of the life she had before. The people who will continue living while time stands still for her out in the desert. Closest to where her head will lay each of the sweltering and explosion-filled nights, she tapes a picture up of her and her love. They were happy that day. Happy in an uncomplicated, naive, and unhardened way. Her love will tape an identical picture up 2 weeks later by his cot, 80 miles south in Baghdad. She considers how she will never be that person again and unpacks the darkest, heaviest part of her baggage. The knowing that that mid-20s carefree girl who boarded the plane to take her to the other side of the world will never return. She will never again be the girl who never went to war. She will never again be a girl whose friends didn't die from mortars. She will become someone who doesn't jump at the loud booms of rockets or patter of machine gun fire. She instead will crouch a little and become absolutely awake in those moments. She will know what it actually feels like to fear for your life. And she will become a woman who's come so close to the edge that she could smell the rank metallic sweat of her own mortality. The seat creaks as I sit back, slightly squirming, knee bouncing. Only once in a while do the flashes seem too real. I stand up on my two still strong legs and my breath hitches in my now scarred throat. I walk away from that movie. Slower now, more cautious, lucky for just a sore back that can still bear my weight. And when I look back at that actress who looks so much like me, I see how with her, I'm now a little less, but also so much more.
Former U.S. Army soldier Lisa Van Wormer. You can read more of her work online at BaltimoreFishbowl.com. Tuned to The Signal, I'm Andy Beanstock. We turn next to the story of another veteran of the Iraq War, former U.S. Marine Sergeant Rich Blake. He shared this recollection at the Stoop Storytelling Series in 2010.
I am extremely lucky to be alive. And though it was more than 7 years ago, it's something that I think about every day. I was a sergeant in the U.S. Marines. I was an infantryman. I was what they called an assaultman, which means I specialized in shoulder-fired rocket launchers, 83-millimeter rocket launchers, and also demolitions. And in 2003, I was deployed to Kuwait and then on to Iraq. And about a month after we crossed the border, we were on a convoy, an entire battalion convoy, which is 50, 60 vehicles. And we were on a road, and single file the vehicles were in this road. And I remember on the right side of the road, there were two big buildings. And to the left, there was a big open field. But separating us from that field was a canal, and it was about 20 feet wide. And I remember it had this rainbowish tint to it, as if there was oil or gasoline that had been spilled in there. And we were patrolling outside of our vehicles, just walking along. And I remember I had a mouthful of chewing tobacco, and it was really hot, and I was taking pictures with my disposable camera. And we started taking small arms fire from the left side, from the field. And one thing about gunshots is that there's a very distinct difference in the sound between gunshots in general and then gunshots that are being fired at you. And that's that regular gunshots, you just hear the bang from the rifle. But when they're coming at you, you hear the whizzing sound as they pass you. I had heard these sounds before, but I had never heard them this loud. So I was able to assume that they were fairly close to me. And now the Marines ahead of me had, they were lucky enough to have a small mound of dirt to get behind. We call them berms in the Marine Corps. But they get down behind this berm, and I didn't feel like I had enough time to get up there and get behind this berm with them. I felt like I needed to get down right away. So I got down on the ground as low as I could, but I had really had nothing to hide behind. And these sounds were getting louder and louder. A young Marine to my right yelled at me, and he said, "Sergeant, they're getting very close to your head." And he was watching the impacts on the ground, you know, getting closer to me. And as he said that, I looked at him, and a bullet hit the ground 5-6 inches in front of my face, and it kicked dirt into my eye and into my mouth. And I remember I closed my eyes, and I was digging my helmet as far down into the ground as I could, trying to get low. And I remember I teared up and kind of conceded at that moment that I probably wasn't going to make it. And then all of a sudden something clicked, and I was like, man, I got to move. I had this bag that had 3 rockets in it, and these rockets are about this long. They weigh 15 pounds apiece. So what I did was I jumped up and I held the bag in front of my face to run to the berm, hoping that if I got hit that the rockets would stop the bullet from reaching me. While this was going on, the platoon had moved over a small bridge over the canal, and they got behind another hill and they were firing into this field. And so I run over there and I get down, and I remember I dove onto the ground, and next to me was Sergeant Cologne, who was my roommate back stateside, and he was one of my best friends, Puerto Rican guy, and he was a machine gunner. And so we're sitting there, and we're completely covered because of the hill. I mean, we couldn't have been shot because we were behind this hill. And all of a sudden, bullets start hitting the hill that we're on. So it must be coming from behind us. And we really couldn't figure it out because behind us was the road. That's where all of the Marines were. So we couldn't figure it out. And so we backed up a little bit and got down in the embankment where the canal was. And bullets were, you know, hitting the ground between us and on both sides of us. And he was one of the toughest guys that I knew. And I remember him screaming, like, "What the hell is going on?" at the top of his lungs. You know, this is one of the guys I looked up to as being, like, real hardcore. So when I seen, like fear in his eyes, I was really scared. And some Marines down to our right had located the people that were shooting at us. And where they were, it was 3 or 5 guys that were in a drainage pipe below the road. Our troops were right above them. We had a vehicle right above them. And so when we started returning fire into this drainage pipe, the Marines on the road thought that they were being shot at from our position. And they couldn't see us, and they didn't know we were down there, so they started returning fire on us. So at this point, we're taking fire from the field, from this drainage pipe, and then from our own troops. And there was definitely a moment when I looked at him. I think I told him that I loved him, and I really didn't think that I didn't think I was going to make it. What would have normally happened is we would have, you know, peppered that whole field with artillery and with Hellfire missiles from Cobra helicopters, but there was another fight on the other side of the road, and they had the priority on those things, so we were kind of on our own. And coming out of the field, I see they were carrying Corporal Silva out. He was dead, and a couple other buddies of mine had got, you know, shot up pretty bad, and they were carrying them out. We finally got access to the artillery and to the helicopters, so we kind of, you know, backed up and peppered this whole field with artillery. And I remember everyone, you know, screaming. Everyone was holding their helmets up and cheering because we had made it. A couple of weeks later, I found a diary. It was an Iraqi soldier's diary. And I kept it, and I started keeping my diary on the other side of it. And The first entry that I wrote was about the story that I just told you. And just to kind of give you an idea of like the toll that this was taking on me, I wanted to share an excerpt from the diary entry. And it says, "I think about my ex-girlfriends a lot. I really don't want to die here and never find out what it's like to fall in love. I think about sex a lot too, because it's been so long. But mostly I think about food and water, because it's been scarce. As I write this, a sniper keeps shooting at me, but I don't even duck anymore. What for? I really think I'm going crazy." Thank you.
U.S. Marine Corps veteran Rich Blake sharing his story in front of a live audience at the Stoop in 2010. He currently heads up a veterans community service program in Baltimore called the Sixth Branch. They're online at thesixthbranch.org. You're tuned to The Signal. I'm Andy Bienstock. In this segment of our program, we're listening to stories of American heroism. We've heard from two former soldiers, and we turn now to the story of a former nun. Liz McAllister is part of Jonah House in Baltimore, a community committed to nonviolent resistance to militarism, war, and the weapons of war. She shared this tale earlier this month at the Stoop.
It was the wee hours of Thanksgiving morning, 1983, and with six friends, I had just climbed through the fence onto the property of Griffiths Air Force Base in Rome, New York. And we intended to be, by morning, the Griffiths Plowshares. At Jonah House, the community that I've lived in here in Baltimore since 1973, we spent a lot of time with the prophecy of Isaiah. And we're especially moved by his mandate that we beat swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks, that nation not learn war anymore. Living in a country that was working on and almost at first strike nuclear capability, that rang clear to us, but how? How do we beat swords into plowshares? We began moving towards some understanding of that with the first plowshares group, the Plowshares 8, my husband Phil, his brother Dan, and six others, went into the GE facility in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, and hammered and poured their blood on the Mark 12A warheads. We were looking that Thanksgiving morning at the B-52, which was the final stage in our nation's first strike nuclear capability with air-launched cruise missiles. These planes that had done so much damage in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, were now being retrofitted to project nuclear cruise missiles on our so-called enemies. We got through the fence. Our next obstacle was the perimeter road, which we understood was constantly surveilled, trucks going on it, across the road with no problem. And we headed up across the golf course to get to it was a place where the airmen learned to upload cruise missiles into the belly and under the wings of the B-52. So we started across the golf course, and 360 degrees all around us, the place was alive with sirens. I grabbed hold of Jackie Allen. I said, "Jackie, we must have tripped something." But we kept walking. We kept moving toward our goal. About half an hour, 40 minutes later, you could see it just over the rise, this hangar. And as we got closer, there was a light coming from the hangar. The big doors that allowed, the roll-up doors that allowed the B-52 access, they were about 3 feet off the ground, and there was light underneath them. There was lights on in this hangar. We could have gone in underneath the big door, but we chose the human door instead, which was also unlocked and open. We went in, the lights were on, the doors were open, and there was no one there except us. Already, Vern Rossman had started using his hammer. We came armed with hammers, household hammers, a bottle of our own blood, baby bottle, and some pictures, spray paint, and things that we wanted to leave as a call to something different. Vern started immediately to hammer on the B-52. I said, "Vern, you're making too much noise. You know, you can't hammer on metal without making noise. Wake up." So I took my hammer and began working with him. Jackie was with us, and she was using a hammer her brother-in-law had used when he was part of the Trident 9 plowshares. Second blow, the head came off her hammer, so she was finished with that. We took the blood then and poured it on the, down the sides of the plane and on the floor and began putting pictures of children and messages that we spray-painted on the floor. Meanwhile, our four friends were in the back of that, another section of that hangar, and they were addressing some of the engines for the B-52 and for vehicles, airplanes that would accompany it on its missions. 10 minutes after we went in, we were all assembled outside the hangar. We unfurled our banner. The sirens were still apparent, but they were much less offensive. Might have been me. And we all breathed gratitude for being able to do what we wanted to do. But at that point, Carl Smith said, "You know, I saw a phone in there. And maybe we could get a call through to our friends in Syracuse." So he and Claire Grady went back in. He picked up the phone. He was immediately in touch with the switchboard operator. And he said, "Happy Thanksgiving to you. Could I please have an outside line?" And she responded in kind. And he called our friends in Syracuse. And they came out and shared this amazing bit of information with us. But something else. He said, "You've got to come back in and look at this." Because in the corner of the hangar was a pylon with six cruise missiles just sitting there. This is what they would load underneath the wings of the B-52. And his question was, should we mark these as well? Well, I, for one, and I think it was terror more than wisdom, I said, "No, no. Let's stay with what we planned, because we've done it, and we don't know enough about it. Also, we want always to preserve the symbol. This is not an orgy of violence or an orgy of destruction. We always have to weigh the damage that we do with the risks we take in our own lives. Otherwise, it's just destruction for its own sake." That seemed to be satisfying. We all went back out, and I could notice on the perimeter road, dawn was beginning to break. There was a car down there, so we moved our banner and ourselves to that road. And shortly thereafter, other cars came and looked askance at us, and then security was on us. "How'd you get here? Because you're leaving the same way you came," was how he introduced it. Kathleen Rumpf was our appointed spokesperson, and she said, "Well, before you escort us off the base, you may want to look in that hangar, because we've done our plowshares action there. And when you see it, you may want not to escort us off the base." And they did, and they didn't. "Lie down on the ground, face down, don't move." We had all these guns at us. Well, it was cold, it had begun to rain, but we had all these guns on us, so we lay on the ground. Probably about an hour, and then they brought a bus up, put us on the bus, drove to another building. No idea where we were. But we sat on that bus all day. It was about 5-6 o'clock before we were brought into the building that we were sitting outside of and were questioned by FBI. I'm not very fond of FBI. I'm sorry if anybody here has that affiliation, but I think the only question I answered was to say, "No, we didn't do anything you couldn't see." So we went from there to the jail in Syracuse, New York, and we thought we'd be there for the duration. We learned that we were charged with, well, trespass, destruction of government property, conspiracy to destroy government property, sabotage, conspiracy to commit sabotage. That might have been it. But we were looking at 25 years in jail if you added that all up. But some weeks later, we appeared in federal district court in Syracuse. Courtroom was full of friends, even some family members. And it became clear we had deep ties to this community, so we were released on personal recognizance. I called home. The phone was answered by my then 9-year-old daughter, Frida, and she said, "Mom, does that mean it's over?" I said, "Oh no, darling, it's only just begun. We'll have a good talk when I get home." Trial followed about 3 months later, and we were pro se defendants, trying to put on a defense of necessity, given the realities that we all walk with and face. I think we did a remarkable job, and we did a remarkable job continuing to build community in one another and support one another through 3-4 weeks of dealing with witnesses. But the judge ruled that we had not established imminence, which is one of the things we had to establish for necessity, so that our defense could not go to the jury. But the jury did rule us innocent of sabotage, innocent of conspiracy to commit sabotage. And about a month later, we were sentenced. Dean Hammer came to sentencing with this thought that a miracle happened on that base on that morning, and that a miracle could happen in this courtroom. And we want to add that a miracle can happen whenever people of conscience and goodness get together and try to make a difference. We were sentenced that day and went immediately to jail and then to prison. The three men and I got 3 years, and the other three women, 2 years, which we served and maxed out on. Maybe a little wiser for it. Thank you.
Liz McAllister of Jonah House shared her story in front of a live audience earlier this month at the Stoop Storytelling Series.